Once upon a time, there was a lion, the king of all beasts, who was lying asleep when he was disturbed by a little mouse who was running across his body. And the lion woke and swatted the mouse and caught him and was about to drop this little mouse whole into his mouth and gobble him up when the little mouse said, "Excuse me, sir. Excuse me, king of the beasts, but won't you spare my life? And who knows, maybe at some point, someday, I might be able to return the favor." And the lion laughed a jolly big old laugh. He was tickled pink by this idea, and he decided, by the sheer amusement of it, to let the little mouse go. And sure enough, some time later, the lion was caught by some hunters, and these hunters had tied him down and had gone off to fetch the wagon to bring back and to take the lion alive to the king. When the little mouse happened to stumble across the lion in his plight. And so, of course, the mouse came up and to return the favor, began to gnaw through the ropes. And when he finally did gnaw through those ropes and set the lion free, he said to the old big lion, "King of the beasts, was I not right that I might return the favor to you?" And so at the end of the day, we see that these little friends can be great friends, especially with the mouse to the lion. And so this famous fable reminds me of an interview with the infamous Hugh Hefner from Playboy fame, who professed a minimal belief in God and said that the God of Christianity was just too childlike for him. Or in other words, for a lion like himself, he couldn't see any merit or value in a mouse like Christianity. But when he was challenged with the resurrection of Jesus, he did say this. He said, "If one had any real evidence that indeed Jesus did return from the dead, then that is the beginning of a series of dominoes that takes us to all kinds of wonderful things. It assures an afterlife and all kinds of things that we would hope for." And so, as you probably know, we're spending some time looking at the resurrection. And so 2 weeks ago, we ended off a series called Jesus Is, where we looked at Jesus miraculously raising Lazarus to life. And we looked at it as a sign of his own miraculous resurrection that we celebrated on Easter Sunday. And then, of course, last week we came and we picked up a series that we started last year in the book of Acts. And we picked it up at Peter's speech to the crowd that had gathered on the day of Pentecost. And we looked at that message there that he shared, that preach, and we saw how it came and it centered on the resurrection. And we're using these couple of weeks to come and take a closer look at the resurrection. And last week we came and we asked the question, what kind of resurrection does the Bible speak of? It's a bodily resurrection. And the second question is how should we respond to this claim of a bodily resurrection of Jesus? Well, we certainly can't be blasé or indifferent. We should be astounded. We should be amazed or aghast at these lies or amazed and stand in awe at the sheer profound nature of it. But we can't be indifferent. And so today I want to take some time and present some evidence to you. And I want to build a case, so to speak, for the resurrection of Jesus. But I need to say a couple of things. I need to say a couple of disclaimers, if I might. And the first is this, is that this is a monumental topic that I need to work through, and I've really labored with this. And so to do this in half an hour is going to be a miracle. And some of you are even laughing right now at the idea of Steph preaching for half an hour or less. But let me remind you that the previous weeks I have done that. But today is probably going to be a little bit longer. And the second thing is that I just want to say that I've relied heavily upon Lee Strobel's book, A Case for Christ, and the interviews that he's documented there. And then the third thing I want to say is that this message today is something of an apologist's defense of the resurrection of Jesus, which means I'm pitching this more at a secular audience, which means that I'll not be relying that heavily on scripture, which means that if I am quoting scripture or referring to scripture, I'm not referring to it as a faith-based manuscript that we go to for our beliefs, but rather as a source of historical evidence, as a historical document. And so, And so when we come to the resurrection, we might ask, why is it important? And why is it important to us? Well, as Hefner implies, it is, if it is true, then there is this domino effect that begins to take us into all kinds of wondrous things. And for that reason, we need to come and ascertain whether it's true or not. And so remember what Tim Keller said last week. He said, if Jesus rose from the dead, then you have to accept all that he said. And if he didn't rise from the dead, then why worry about any of what he said? The issue on which everything hangs is not whether or not you like his teaching, but whether or not he rose from the dead. And so this is the question that we want to answer today, that we want to come and present evidence for, is did Jesus really rise from the dead? And so many people mistakenly believe that to be a Christian, you have to come and you have to adopt a blind faith, that you have to check your brains out at the door in order to be a believer. But that's the furthest thing from the truth. And so today I want to come and ask you to do the very opposite. I want to ask you to come and to keep your brains, don't check them out. And I want to ask you to mentally, to work hard mentally and to stay with me and to try and keep up with me as I go through something of a whirlwind tour of the evidence that we can look at to come and defend the resurrection of Jesus Christ as a historical event and fact. And so before we go any further, I'd like you to answer this question. In the groups that you're in or with the person next to you, do you believe Jesus was naturally raised to life? Great. Well, I would be intrigued to hear the answers out there, and you might be interested to know that I don't believe that Jesus was naturally raised to life again. And so admittedly, this question is phrased in a little bit of an awkward way and is a bit of a trick question, but it's an important question to ask because the distinction it makes is vital for us. You see, I don't believe that Jesus was naturally raised to life again. I believe that Jesus was supernaturally raised to life. You see, the Bible and the disciples and the apostles and the Christian faith doesn't come and claim that Jesus came back to life through natural processes, but rather through the supernatural intervention of God. And so some historians and most skeptics out there cannot believe in the resurrection, not for a lack of evidence, but because they rule out the possibility of the supernatural from the very beginning. And so the resurrection for those skeptics is not a matter of evidence as much as it's a matter of worldview, a worldview that doesn't include God or the supernatural. And so their argument in its simplest boils down to the belief that the resurrection is impossible because God does not exist. And so if you're one of those people that doesn't believe God exists, I don't have the time or the space right now to come and present evidence for that, because the question we're answering today is not does God exist, but rather did Jesus rise from the dead? And so as we move forward, we have to move forward with the assumption that you believe in a God or a higher power and in the supernatural. And so as we do that, you might say, well, then doesn't that present us a problem? Because if historians and academics believe in God and therefore believe in the supernatural and therefore believe in the possibility of the miraculous, does that not throw history up for grabs? Does that not mean anyone can come and invoke some kind of miraculous explanation for historical events that have happened? For instance, Sir Alex Ferguson, right? The reason why Manchester United were so dominant for so many years was because Sir Alex Ferguson actually could see the future, and he could see the games and the game plans of his opponents before they actually happened, and so he had that advantage. Or Steve Jobs, the reason why he was so successful was because he tapped into an alternative universe and an advanced civilization from whom he imported their technology into our world. Or T-Swizzle, the reason why she's so successful is she hears voices, angelic voices that help her with her songs and with her lyrics, and that's why she's so good at what she does. And so is it possible to defend or refute any of those? And so perhaps the question we should ask is, does allowing for the miraculous throw history up for grabs? why don't you press pause and chat that through with the person next to you or the group that you're with now? Well, the simple answer to this question is no. No, the miraculous doesn't throw history up for grabs, because you still have to come and apply the discipline of historical criteria to each and every situation to determine the best explanation for what happened. And so when we consider the story that I told at the beginning of this message about the lion and the mouse, it is in fact one of Aesop's fables, which goes back more than 2,500 years ago. And these fables tell stories of animals that have the miraculous ability to communicate and talk to each other. And so the question we might ask is, well, did they have the ability to talk or didn't they? Well, when we examine the historical criteria for these fables, we find that firstly, that the genre is not meant to be interpreted literally. That secondly, there's no credible eyewitness accounts. And thirdly, there is no corroborating evidence from other sources. And so when historians come and view these fables, they see that there's no credible evidence that Aesop's fables report actual historical events. And so what do you think will happen when we come and apply historical criteria to Christ and to the resurrection? What do you think we will find? Well, that's exactly what we're going to do with the rest of our time. And we're going to come and apply the three R's of historical criteria. The first R being relevant resources, which comes and looks at what resources do we have that are reliable, that we can trust, that present evidence on the events in question. And so just as an example, in the context of relevant resources, when it comes to Aesop's fables, there are the first document that describes anything from Aesop is not written by him, but by someone else. And it comes some 200 years after his death. And even then, there's one or two mentions of him, and no one's really sure if he really existed. When we come and consider Alexander the Great, the two most important documents used to document his life were only written some 400 years after he died. And when we consider Caesar Augustus, largely considered the greatest Roman emperor to ever live, there are only five main resources that academics and historians use to describe his life. The first of which is a brief funeral inscription. The second is a document written between 50 and 100 years after he died. And the third is three documents that were written some 100 to 200 years after he died. But when it comes to Christ and to the resurrection, it's a different story. You see, we have secular sources that come and talk of Christ and the resurrection in Tacitus, the Roman historian, in Josephus, the Jewish historian, in Pliny the Younger, the provincial governor. And some secular sources include Phalius and Phlegon and Philo and Celsus, and other resources include the Talmud and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And even within the faith, we've got the apostolic fathers like Clement of Rome and Polycarp, and we've got the Gnostic writings and the various creeds that were passed down. And then, of course, we also have the Bible itself, which didn't start out as the Bible as we know it today, but started out as these manuscripts, a compilation in time of biographies and letters that were written, and that for the purpose of today need to be viewed through the lens of historical documents. And so let's take a moment and watch a video clip from the Alpha Film Series and see what their expert there comes and tells us about the Bible and the manuscripts that make up the Bible and how they stack up as a historical resource that is relevant and reliable.
Examines the number of copies of early texts that we have available to us today. And it looks at the time gap between the original document and the earliest copy that we have. And basically, the more manuscripts we have and the earlier they are, the less doubt there's going to be about the original. So let's compare the Bible to other texts in ancient history, ones that are widely used in schools and universities. Let's look at the Greek historians Herodotus and Thucydides. They both wrote in the 5th century BC. But the earliest copy of their writings that we have dates from AD 900, and that makes a 1300-year time lapse. And even then, we only have 8 copies of these manuscripts in the first place. Or look at the Roman historian Tacitus. There's a 1,000-year gap between his book being written and our first manuscript, and we only have 20 copies. Or another classic, Caesar's Gallic War, 950 years between the book being written and our first manuscript copy. And even then, we only have 9 or 10 copies of these manuscripts. Again, with Livy's famous History of Rome, a 900-year gap between the book being written and our first manuscript, and we only have 20 copies of this. But when it comes to the New Testament, well, it's very different. The New Testament was written between about 40 and 100 AD, and we have manuscript evidence going back as early as 130 AD, and full manuscripts by 350 AD. And we have more than 5,300 Greek manuscripts, 10,000 Latin translations, and 9,300 others. So, you know, we can be pretty confident in the accuracy, the authenticity, and the integrity of the New Testament scriptures that have been passed down to us today. The remarkable thing about the Bible is there's such a short chronological distance between the events being described and our first manuscripts. So in many ways, the Bible scholars are in a very fortunate position of being able to check these things out and finding that they are much more reliable than, for example, some of the alternatives you're looking at.
And so I hope you can see that when it comes to historical evidence dating back 1,500 years or more, and when it comes to the historical criteria, namely relevant resources, that the resources relating to Jesus and his resurrection and the early church are arguably unrivaled in all of history. Which brings us to our second R of historical criteria, which is the responsible method. Which means once all the relevant resources have been identified, we need to apply a responsible method to the evidence it details. In other words, we need to take all the evidence and we need to add a weight to it, a weight of how truthful and how authentic is this. And obviously there are certain things that have a greater weighting. And so it means assigning the greatest weight to reports that are early, in other words, closest to when the actual events happened, from eyewitnesses, from enemies, from skeptics, from reports that are embarrassing and reports that are corroborated or confirmed by others. And so in a moment, we'll see how this works itself out when it comes to Jesus. But for now, it must be said that this kind of historical discipline of working out a hypothesis, that there is no such thing as 100% certainty, and that sometimes all that history leaves us is a pile of ashes. And the historian Richard Evans, a philosopher of history, he said this, that the task of historians is to rake up those ashes in order to bring some of them back to life to see what happened in the past. And so historians simply come and take the evidence that they have, and they come and they hypothesize. They take theories from the evidence they have, and they need to then put them on a continuum of certainty. And then they take competing theories, stack them up against each other, and the one that has the greatest weight to it, that stacks up the best and is most probable, is the one that then needs to be chosen. But of course, there's always a bias. There's always a bias. And so no matter how hard anyone tries, that when it comes to historical evidence and viewing historical evidence, that's impossible to not view them through the lenses of our own prejudice. And so in order to reduce that bias, the historian Gary Habermas created what's called the minimal facts approach when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus. And under this approach, evidence needs to meet two criteria. Namely, first, there must be strong historical evidence. In other words, strong relevant resources, the first R. And secondly, the evidence must be strong enough that the vast majority of today's scholars on the subject, including skeptical ones, accept these as historical facts. And so this doesn't mean that history is up for the vote, that you can vote what history is, but it means that there is such a thing as strong historical evidence that even skeptical scholars can accept it. And so Michael Lycona said this. He said, "Let's face it, there's a greater likelihood that a purported historical fact is true when someone accepts it, even when they're not in agreement with your metaphysical beliefs." And so using all of the above criteria, meaning that they come from the relevant and reputable resources, and that the responsible method has been applied. And it's been applied to such a degree that the vast majority of historians and scholars and even skeptics out there accept it as truth. Applying this criteria, I now want to present to you five facts. Five facts that not I've come up with, but Lee Strobel in his book has come up with, and I want to present them to you. Just five, and I want to show you how compelling they are. And so, fact number one, Jesus was killed by crucifixion. And so even the most hardened of historians and the greatest of skeptics would come and agree across the board that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. In fact, it is a tiny, tiny minority, a small percentage, perhaps 1% of the academic community that would say that Jesus didn't die on the cross, and they would by and large be laughed at by the rest of the community. This is what I've read in the last week. And so beyond scripture, Josephus and Tacitus and Lucian of Samosata and a man called Mara Ber Serapion and even the Talmud come and attest to the fact that Jesus died through crucifixion. And the extreme liberal, John Dominic Crossan, says this. He says that he, Jesus, was crucified is as sure as anything historical can ever be. And the skeptic James Tabor, he says this: I think we need have no doubt that given Jesus' execution by Roman crucifixion, he was truly dead. And so, fact number one, Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Fact number two, Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and appeared to them. And so there are three strands of evidence that come and build towards this. The first is Paul's testimony of the disciples. The second is the oral traditions passed down through the church. And the third is the written works of the early church, which include Clement of Rome, who was ordained by Peter, as well as Polycarp, who was instructed by the apostles. And so all of these evidences don't just come and simply point to the fact that the disciples believed in a resurrected Jesus, but also that they were transformed to the point that they were willing to endure persecution and even a martyred death for their beliefs. And so this isn't martyrdom like a suicide bomber who's blindly going in and believing and hoping that he's believing in the right thing, but doesn't know for sure. No, this martyrdom of the disciples is based on whether they saw the resurrected Jesus or not. And only they would know. Only they would know. And so as they were busy being beaten and whipped and persecuted and killed and breathing their last breath, they would have known whether or not they saw the resurrected Jesus and whether they were dying for a lie or not. Charles Carlson puts it like this. He says, I know the resurrection is a fact, and Watergate proved it to me. How? Because 12 men testified they'd seen Jesus raised from the dead, and then they proclaimed that truth for 40 years, never once denying it. Everyone was beaten, tortured, stoned, and put in prison. They'd not have endured it if it weren't true. Watergate embroiled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they couldn't keep alive for 3 weeks. You're telling me 12 apostles could keep alive for 40 years? Absolutely impossible. And so, fact number one, Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Fact number two, Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and appeared to them. Fact number three, the conversion of the church persecutor Paul. And so the life of Paul is well documented in the writings of Luke, of Clement of Rome, of Polycarp, of Tertullian, of Dionysius of Corinth, and of Origen. And it's well documented that Saul of Tarsus was a persecutor of the church, that he came and he presided over the stoning of Stephen, that he went and he searched out followers of the way and had them imprisoned. And so he hated the church and he hated its followers. But Paul's conversion is significant because, number one, he was an enemy of Jesus. Number two, he claims to have encountered Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, on the Damascus Road, which makes him a potential primary source. And thirdly, what makes his story and this fact so strong, if it is true, is the role that he went on to play, the significant role that he went on to play in the church. And so Michael Lycona says, you can't claim Paul was a friend of Jesus, who was primed to see a vision of him due to wishful thinking or grief after his crucifixion. Paul was a most unlikely candidate for conversion. His mindset was to oppose the Christian movement that he believed was following a false Messiah. His radical transformation from persecutor to missionary demands an explanation, and I think the best explanation is that he's telling the truth when he says he met the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus. And so, fact number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Fact number two, Jesus' disciples claim to have encountered the risen Jesus. Fact number three is the conversion of the enemy of the church, enemy and persecutor of the church, Paul. Fact number four is the conversion of the skeptic, James, Jesus' half-brother. And so you might be surprised to hear that Jesus had brothers, but scripture talks about Jesus having half-brothers, namely James and Joseph and Judas and Simon. And in fact, in John chapter 7, we read an encounter between Jesus and his brothers, and we can see how unbelieving his brothers are and how they taunt him. It says there in verse 3, "So his brothers said to him, 'Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples may also see the works you're doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world.' For not even his brothers believed in him." And so, not only did the brother, the half-brother of Jesus, James, come to faith after Jesus appeared to him, but he also went on to play a prominent role in the early church, even leading the church in Jerusalem. But more than that, he went on to die a martyr's death himself. And so imagine for a moment what it would take for you to believe that your older brother was the Son of God, that he was God. Imagine what it would take to convince you. Now, I've got a brother and he's great and I love him. And let's leave it at there. Let's leave it there. But it would take, I mean, I'm stumbling here because I'm just processing it. What would it take for me to believe that my older brother, Conrad, is the Son of God? It would take something amazing. Now, I love my brother, but I don't believe he's the Son of God. What would it take for you to believe that your brother, your older brother, is the Son of God? I mean, it would be something mind-blowing. It would have to be the resurrection of Jesus, surely. The encountering the resurrected Jesus. Surely that's all that could come and do it. And so fact number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Fact number two, his disciples believed that he rose and appeared to them. Fact number three is that is the conversion of the enemy of the church and persecutor of the church, Paul. Fact number four is the conversion of the skeptic James, Jesus' half-brother. And fact number five is Jesus' tomb was empty. Of all of these five facts, this last fact here is probably the weakest of all of them. And so the previous four probably enjoy universal support in terms of being registered as a fact among scholars and academics and historians. But according to Gary Habermas, the guy who put together the minimal fact approach for the resurrection, he would claim that this last fact enjoys much less support. And it only enjoys 75%, around about 75% support from the academic community. Which firstly tells us of how high the support is for the other facts. But also 75% is not a low percentage. That is a high percentage. And so for this fact, there are three strands of evidence that people would apply. The first is the Jerusalem factor. The second is the enemy attestation. The third is the testimony of women. And so starting with the first one, the Jerusalem factor is this, is that Jesus died in Jerusalem. He was buried in Jerusalem. And a couple of days later, people started to proclaim that he had risen from the dead. And so from that very first moment, that very first word went out, people would have gone to the tomb to check for themselves. And even as it went on, people would have gone there and they would have had the opportunity to go and to look and to see. And so it would have been impossible for Christianity to get off the ground if Jesus' body was still in the tomb. In fact, the authorities could very easily have said, just go to the tomb, there's the body there, there it is there, and call it, you know, call it what it is. But they didn't do that. In fact, it brings us to the second evidence, the attestation of enemies, what the enemies were saying. And so the authorities weren't saying, go and look at the body. What were they saying? They said the disciples had stolen the body. And so this is reported not only in the Gospel of Matthew, but also by Justin Martyr and Tertullian. And so the accusation was that the disciples stole the body of Jesus. But isn't it interesting that this accusation is in fact an admission that the tomb was empty, that the body was not there? That's the second one. The third one is the testimony of the woman. And so in the Gospels and in that day, and so in the Gospels, it's the woman that come and discover the tomb and the empty tomb. And so in those days, in that time, in that culture, women were esteemed lowly. They weren't highly regarded, and their testimony was highly questionable. And it sounds terrible, doesn't it? But that's how it was back then. And so the point of this is that if you were going to come and make up a story of an empty tomb, you'd want reliable witnesses to come and to stand up for that. The best possible witnesses, in fact. And so Michael Lycona says, if you were going to concoct a story in an effort to fool others, you would never in that day have hurt your own credibility by saying that the woman discovered the empty tomb. And so when you come and take these three together and you put it together, it's pretty compelling. And so fact number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Fact number two, his disciples believed he rose and that they saw him. Fact number three is the conversion of the enemy of the church, Paul. Fact number four is the conversion of the skeptic, James, the half-brother of Jesus. And fact number five is the empty tomb. And so if you take each one of these separately and individually, they are interesting and compelling in and of themselves. But I don't know that they'd convince me that the resurrection is real. But if you come and you put them together, they come and they make a pretty compelling story and account that needs to then be weighed up. And so this brings us to the third R in historical criteria, namely restrained results. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is the best explanation for the evidence? The explanation that doesn't leave out any of the facts or strains to make anything fit. And so when we come and we look at the evidence that we've just looked at here, we see that there's a man called Jesus who died on a cross, and he was put in a tomb, and that sometime later his disciples attest to seeing him. And we see that a man called Paul, who was a great skeptic and enemy, was converted, and another man called James, who was the half-brother of Jesus, a skeptic as well, came to faith. And that all of these guys, along with the disciples, believed in Jesus and in the resurrection so deeply and so profoundly that they were willing to be persecuted and beaten and brutalized and even martyred for the sake of what they believed. And so we have these women that come and attest to the empty tomb. These guys come and attest to it. And on the day of Pentecost, this passage that we're camping out in the book of Acts, Peter comes and he refers to it, that Jesus rose to life again. And so this is the evidence that we have. This is the evidence that we've looked at here. And we need to come and we need to weigh it up and we need to decide for ourselves. And so the question we're asking today is, did Jesus really rise to life again? Was he raised from the dead? And so for some of us, the problem isn't the evidence. That's not the issue. That's not the stumbling block. The issue is, in fact, our worldview. We have a worldview where we're saying, how can a lion like me benefit or find any value in a mouse like Jesus or the gospel? But we need to come and move past our worldview, and we need to come and weigh up the evidence. And as you weigh up the evidence, what do you say? Did Jesus really rise to life again? I'm going to leave the last words for N.T. Wright, the great historian and biblical scholar, and he says this: it is not good falling back on science as having disproved the possibility of the resurrection. Any real scientist will tell you that science observes what normally happens. The Christian case is precisely that what happened to Jesus is not what normally happens. For my part, as a historian, I prefer the elegant, essentially simple solution rather than the one that fails to include all the data. To say that the early Christians believed that Jesus had been bodily raised from the dead and to account for his belief by saying that they were telling the truth. What do you say? Did Jesus rise to life again or not?